This question about letting a stranger in is interesting because, like, probably most of you know, my husband is a police officer. He's even suspicious of, like, hiring help, domestic help. So I guess for him, and because of him, for me as well, peace is defined really negatively as, like, rejecting possibilities of conflicts or
security.
But, like, I like the idea of, like, hospitality, like, what you raised, because I've been thinking about, like, between, like, a meditative religious peace and really, like, peace as opposed to warfare. For me, like, peace might be negotiating your way with the world to see if you can come up with a relationship with the world that you feel good about, so that you feel that you are in a hospitable world, that you are, and you also be a good host to other people. So for me, it's like navigating through the world to find the kind of a peaceful, harmonious relationship. And it seems that nowadays, a lot of times, we're being asked to fight. Like, fight for your right, or, like, fight against. There's so many things you have to fight against nowadays. So it's difficult to find, like, a peaceful relationship, it seems. Not a very hospitable world, but something that I like to strive for, I guess.
For me, letting somebody into my home is very important. Hospitality is very important to me. This idea that you would send a certain amount to be hospitable is something that I was taught from my parents' generation. And I think for me, in relation to peace, it's this idea that to give hospitality, to give a sense of courtesy, is to remain intrinsically good within myself, to define myself in a certain way that I'm able to do that, I think gives me peace within myself.
To move away from the question of hospitality, I mean, you posed the question of whether peace could ever be achieved, and I remember when I was a teenager, I was an avid fan of The X-Files, and in one episode, Mulder encounters this being who can grant him three wishes, and one of the wishes, he actually said that he wished for peace on Earth. And what happened was all human beings disappeared from the face of this Earth. And so it's quite, I mean, that again is quite a negative definition of peace. We can only achieve peace if there are no more human beings in this world. And I'm teaching Virginia Woolf right now, the essay Three Guineas, which is very much about why human beings have to wage war. And Virginia Woolf has a very interesting take on it, which is that the private world is inevitably connected with the public world. So negative emotions that we feel privately, such as jealousy and competition, actually are the sources of conflict in the public world. And to connect this back to Buddhism and meditation, I think in order to really achieve peace, we have to be at peace with ourselves first. And this is something that really that remains to be striven for, that we might actually never be able to achieve. I mean, that's a very skeptical take on peace that I have.
Yeah. I mean, you asked, like, would I invite a stranger to my home? But it has to do with, I mean, if you invite a stranger, and then there'll be, you know, you'll be vigilant, right? You watch over the other person, but you watch over yourself as well. And it takes discipline to be polite. And it takes discipline for that sort of peace between people to exist. And it's just a lot of work. And to the point that sometimes peace becomes just this whole, you know, it's just such a hassle that it becomes not very peaceful, you know, to the self. So, you know, I'm kind of like, you know, well, you know, hell is other people.
So where do you find peace in your own life? Is it?
I think when I'm with myself doing, you know, it's just very basic stuff, doing stuff I like. I guess it's a bit insular. It's a bit private, you know. But I think it is something meaningful, you know, because sometimes when the word peace to me, I think of, you know, that feel miscongeniality, you know. What do you want in the world? Peace, you know. It becomes sometimes a bit banal, so, you know, I'm looking for peace, I'm searching for peace. It just doesn't work. for me, in a sense. So I guess I grew up, if this is anecdotal, with the notion that peace was an inner thing. In other words, it was to do with those more meditative and religious aspects of the world, more than the political and strategic and military aspect. But then I spent 10 years as a diplomat, and that kind of knocks the stuffing out of you as far as a more inner conception of peace is concerned. And I was brought up very strongly in a kind of tradition that hospitality is a duty. You have a duty as a, not exactly as a host, but there is a host-guest relationship that it's. We lived overseas when I was a child, and that was very strongly part of the ethos.
Are you all like Hong Kong citizens? Or?
I'm a permanent resident.
Yeah, I'm from Hong Kong.
I've been here for, well, not more than 7 years. So.
Yeah, I was born here.
You were born here.
I found it interesting that some of the students that we talked to weren't worried about 2046.
Mm.
They weren't worried that Hong Kong was eventually going to be a part of China. And to me, I guess, from my outside perspective, I would be very worried. So for example, if Canada was going to be a part of the United States in 30 years, that would worry me very much. And I found it very interesting that it was so subtle here. It was not on the forefront of people's minds, as I understood it, but maybe I might be wrong. And so in relation to this idea of peace, right now Hong Kong is considered somewhat of a democracy, and with this right to protest, this right to voice your own opinion, all that will most likely change by 2046, and I just was wondering why people weren't more vocal about that.
Well, I'm from Singapore. You know, the thing about, you know, there's this issue about legality, the constitution, and also there's everyday life. What is official and what is actual is very different, right? I mean, in Singapore, is there freedom in Singapore? Is there no freedom in Singapore? Nobody knows, right? Legally speaking, you look at the constitution, you know, some of the issues, some of the legal sort of terms are quite problematic. But in terms of everyday life, everyone is free to go if they want to, you know. So I guess this happens in Hong Kong, you know, the legality and so on is one issue. The official world says one thing, but in your everyday life as you grow up or your own business, as long as nobody points a gun at you, you know, that sort of thing, and asks you to do something you wouldn't want to do, you'll be okay.
This is funny, just last night I was thinking about the exact same thing. And to me, 2046 or 2047 is not just one day Hong Kong becomes part of China. It's not like, but on that day, you don't feel any different because it's just a day. It's just like a day on the calendar. But actually the process has already taken place long, long time ago. And so to me, that's kind of what China is trying to do right now, and even a long time before now, trying to kind of prepare for that big day. And that actually brings to my mind another thing we could like leave it, but it's like the definition of peace between Westerners and maybe the Chinese, being specific, are very different. Because maybe I'm not completely representative, but perhaps let's take the classroom, in primary classroom. I don't know what maybe peace is defined, and the peace in the classroom is defined as respect. Like, you respect other people. You can voice your opinions. If Tony hits Guy, then Guy apologizes. That's peace. Everything's sorted out. But in China, if anybody speaks at all, or even in Hong Kong in my classroom, peace is defined as silence, like not saying anything while this authority says something. And maybe that's a bit stereotypical, but protests, at least from what I heard today around the table, that's fine. That's freedom, that's fine. You can, even Liu Xiaobo, like the Nobel Peace Prize winner, he didn't get the prize for not speaking up. He actually, to the Chinese government, he's being the very opposite of peace, because he's trying to get something going.
He causes unrest.
Yes, exactly. That's
public,
why they're...
It's called public disturbance.
Yes. That's a... I don't know if that's something you can get.
What you've defined there is two different definitions of peace.
Yeah.
Peace, what Liu Xiaobo is doing is causing unrest, conflict.
Yeah.
And then we talked about how peace was the sense of inner harmony and stillness.
You're saying on the Chinese model, that's exactly what is not allowed.
Yeah.
So in a way, that goes to the heart of the difference between the English, the Western conception of peace and what you're talking about in China. Protest is a form of peace, is what you're really saying, because it involves negotiating.
It's interesting. I guess there are like so many things right now that you need to worry about. You just don't think that far ahead. But it's interesting because like I went to the U.S. for college, and like now I have a baby coming along, and I was kind of imagining how she might end up going to the mainland for university. Isn't like not impossible or not desirable for someone growing up in this millennium to think that it might be a better idea to go to China for university, for your college education. So I guess I'm being optimistic, thinking that things might get better, and I mean in China. And I haven't just... my thought processes haven't reached 2046 yet. And I guess kids growing up nowadays, I mean, our undergraduates, they also have too much on their mind to be worrying about that. Maybe that's why you think they seem indifferent.
China can do what it wants anyway. I mean, 2046 is a meaningless date. It's not like anyone can tell China that if they don't behave in a certain way before 2046, they're going to get spanked for it. So the date probably really doesn't have... I don't think it's going to have any significance in terms of the future, except a footnote. Hong Kong is a peaceful place. People negotiate things here, and you negotiate it. If somebody has a problem, you try to work out that problem without causing any dramatic disturbance to the social fabric. When I grew up in America, I always appreciated the more open discourse of all topics, including peace and everything else. Everyone in America has an opinion, and they shout it out as loudly as they can. And you can turn on the television in America and think the country is controlled by insane people. They scream at you at the top of their lungs with very rigorous, extremist opinions. And it's nice to have the freedom, but it's also nice to see the sort of discourse in Hong Kong. Different cultures have different approaches to peace. China's a huge society, and maintaining social order has been a lot more important in this part of the world than in the West. The West has evolved certainly more complicated, more sophisticated systems of justice and law over the past 400 years than China has, but I'm sure China has evolved lots of negotiating skills to compensate for that.
I think Hong Kong people are actually... they are quite worried, actually, but on this underlying level. Like Eddie said, there's this everyday level where people just have to do their thing, make their living. And it's something inevitable, basically. And to worry too much about that right now, about something that you can't really change, actually, doesn't seem to be fruitful in any way. I mean, Hong Kong people are just too busy making money, really. I think that's the reality of it.
It's interesting. We had a lunchtime lecture by Audrey Yu, who's one of the legislators in the Hong Kong Assembly, who's very outspokenly pro-democracy. This was last week, and she was actually reporting very much what some of you have been saying, that young Hong Kong people are strangely inactive when it comes to exercising some kind of democratic presence or democratic right. And the notion of... And she actually finds it quite difficult to explain to them why they should. You know, explain concepts like responsibility or long-term consequences if you don't fill that
political space and there's a vacuum, then it gets filled with autocracy, basically. This is what she's saying. But it bears out what you were saying. She finds it's a general worry amongst younger people. At the same time, you know, there is already a growing tradition of political protest in Hong Kong, as with that railway and the village that got that's projected to be flattened to make room for the railroad to Shenzhen. So there is a protest kind of ethos growing as well.
What happened on campus, right?
With the democracy statue.
Yes.
Yeah. Very interesting.
The students erected a goddess of democracy statue that is identical to the goddess of democracy statue that the Beidai students in Beijing erected in Tiananmen Square during the Tiananmen Square riots. So our students erected it on campus, and they appealed to the dean to make it a permanent installation right in front of the train station. And possibly one of the reasons is because Chinese University has very close ties to mainland China, and because they have close ties to mainland China, they don't want to rock the boat. And so they asked the students to take it down.
They use the notion of political impartiality. They want to appear impartial.
Right. And then all the faculty got a general email about the situation and explained in a way how we should really remain impartial.
It did. Wow.
Well, the statue's there. You can see it at the train station.
Well, the reason why it remains there is because the press got a hold of the situation. The students appealed to the press. And so, like, South China Morning Post had huge headlines about what was going on campus, which in the end embarrassed the university into allowing it to remain.
Which suggests that there is a constituency out there which gets fired up by these questions that they could appeal to through the press.
Do you think some Hong Kong people actually have a sense of relief in going back to what they originally came from? Because there's the ethnic connection, Chinese. I mean, most colonies, there's an oppressor there, and when they get rid of that oppressor, they're kind of happy. For Hong Kong, the oppressor's gone, so you're going back to kind of what was there in the 1840s. You know, there's the ethnic connection as well. So do older Chinese people think, we're going back to our homeland?
Maybe a minority of the older generation.
My dad does.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He's very nationalist. Mm-hmm. So he thinks that it's justice that Hong Kong goes back to China.
Yeah.
And that there was lots of injustice done in Britain taking away Hong Kong from China. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's one of those who thinks that it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some people. I mean, we are all Chinese people in the end, so I have to say, I think I'm a bit guilty of the same kind of political inactivity of the younger generation in Hong Kong that you're observing. I think there is the sense that there's not much that we can do right now to change anything, and the hope is there for China to change, so that once we are, well, not just one country, we are one country right now, but once we have the same system, that they can still allow the same kind of democracy that we have right now. And I think that the question of economic dependence also plays a large role, because we are so dependent on China right now, and we will continue to be for the decades to come, that without China we wouldn't be able to cope at all. So what is it that we can do right now? I'm not sure that...
Can do plenty. Hong Kong, well, as many people say in the mainland and in Hong Kong is the cutting edge of democratic thought in China, and I think a lot of leaders in China want to see Hong Kong doing that, actually, but doing it in a responsible way. I don't think the mainland has closed the door on increasing the presence of democratic approaches in the mainland, although they're still insisting on the monopoly of the Communist Party as the governing unit. But I've seen lots of comments by Hong Kong and mainland intellectuals saying that it's good that Hong Kong people are speaking up, and that it sets a good example.
So how do you navigate at home? How do you speak to your father about various contemporary issues? Do you avoid those topics? If you have
we just have very different opinions.
Right.
And I mean, we argue with each other about these things, but I know I can't change his mind, and he can't change mine, so that's fine. We just have our own different opinions. Yeah.
But maybe my mother and father, because we emigrated for a while to Australia because of what they feared would happen to Hong Kong when the Hanover. And then when we talked about, we actually had a discussion at home, a heated debate about the Tiananmen, the goddess of liberty in CU. And the thing is, when you talk about China, especially in relation to Hong Kong, it's very easy to kind of just very simply point a finger and say, China, no freedom and no democracy, no suppression, oppression, very bad, very bad. But it's to China and the Chinese government, biggest difference between how they define peace with the Western governments is that peace can be detached from freedom. And that doesn't seem to be the case, especially hearing what has been discussed today. Like, a lot of the discussion surrounding Hong Kong and China is that we don't have democracy and how we have to struggle for it. But to the Chinese government, that isn't an issue. Like, you can have peace without having that much of a public freedom, because to them, peace is more like, I don't have any civil wars, I don't have any guns or bombs. That, in a sense, makes China a peaceful country.
Singapore is a small place, and there's always this belief that because Singapore is such a multicultural society, there's a lot of right and so on. And if you don't hold things in check, then, you know, once there's a protest, there'll be riots and so on, everything will be dismantled. So a sense of ownership, you know, you own your own home, you own your own private property and so on, you have a stake in Singapore. So the last thing you want to see is war or is, you know, unrest. That's the last thing you want to see.
So the state does not ultimately own property in Singapore?
No.
Because it does in China, right?
Mm-hmm. Where do you feel that you have this sense of dignity if you are not allowed to protest?
Yeah, but it's a bit of a loaded question, because all my life has been like this, so it's not a big issue, because I've never lost that freedom of protest. It's always been, you know, not been there. I'm used to it. It's not even an issue.
During the Sichuan earthquake, well, the government was to blame for a lot of reasons why a lot of people died, because the schools that were built, it was shoddy construction. And so a lot of people lost their children. The way that the Chinese government deals with these kind of situations is they pay off the families. So they make the families sign contracts saying, here's 30,000 RMB for the loss of your son. So remain quiet, right? And if they do not remain quiet, they protest, or they seek out other protesters, then they are silenced.
I think that what we talked about before, about how my generation doesn't seem quite empathetic towards the whole politics, is one of the biggest reasons is that to us, there doesn't seem to be, at least to my peers, there doesn't seem to be a direct link between what I would do out in the streets and what I say, and then the result of the next election. I feel like nobody would care about me if I said something.
Do you think that there is an actual personal sense of satisfaction in just loudly shouting your view, irrespective of whether anybody... I mean, at least in Hong Kong, you're not going to get arrested for doing that, right?
This is very interesting, because for me, I have always been outspoken, but then I'm not very typical of what you would find in... It's not even like a political issue anymore. It's just that the family is very important in Hong Kong. So even the matter of our age would be a reason why people don't go out in the streets, because people would feel like I'm only 20, I'm only 21. And the people in the LegCo are much older than me, so people don't care about what the young people have to say.